This is Generation Justice, a multiracial project that trains youth to harness the power of community through media, narrative, and critical consciousness. I'm Barbara Ramirez. Tonight, on this special edition of Generation Justice, we bring you a lecture from the U.S. Senator Dennis Chavez Endowed Lectureship on Law and Civil Rights, featuring Professor Alvaro Bedoya, founding director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. Professor Bedoya is an expert on government surveillance, commercial data collection, and their impact on immigrants and people of color. Stay with us after the lecture when we speak with Professor Bedoya. To introduce Professor Bedoya, we hear from Gloria Tristani, former FCC commissioner, former commissioner for the New Mexico State Corporation Commission, and a winner of the Edward R. Roybal Award for Outstanding Public Service. Ms. Tristani is also the granddaughter of the late New Mexico Senator Dennis Chavez. Now, please enjoy this presentation of privacy and civil rights in the age of Facebook, ICE, and the NSA, held at the University of New Mexico School of Law.
On behalf of my family, I'm delighted to welcome you to this fourth Senator Dennis Chavez Memorial Lecture on Civil Rights. 10 years ago, as you heard, the Dennis Chavez Foundation and the Chavez family established an endowment to fund a memorial lecture focused on civil rights and celebrating Senator Chavez's extraordinary life and legacy. We thought it was fitting to commemorate his life by focusing on civil rights. My grandfather was unwavering in his belief that it is a moral responsibility to speak up loudly for equality and fairness and against discrimination or injustice, no matter how unpopular or politically risky. We also thought it was fitting because my grandfather believed that education was a key to a better life. Indeed, one of his first acts as a New Mexico state representative was to successfully pass legislation to provide free textbooks for all of the state's school children. Born to a humble family, largely self-educated, Dennis Chavez rose to the highest heights of political power and used that power to better the lives of his fellow New Mexicans, his fellow Americans, but particularly to help people most in need and who could not speak for themselves. And while my grandfather was fiercely American, he took enormous pride in his Spanish heritage. He loved Spanish literature. He loved our neighbors to the south, from Mexico to Argentina, and he did whatever he could to foster better relationships between our country and the Americas. In reflecting on the times we live in, I wonder what my grandfather would make of our country's current political climate, including the erosion of civil rights and liberties. From immigrant babies being ripped from their mother's arms to citizens in Puerto Rico being denied much-needed disaster relief and food assistance, to citizens and others being unfairly targeted by our government because of their race, ethnicity, or religion. Would he recognize the country he so loved and devoted his life to serving? I cannot guess what he would think, but I have no doubt what he would do. He would act and raise his voice against any kind of discrimination, bigotry, and injustice. He would raise his voice against the erosion of civil liberties. He would urge us to do the same. He would urge us to act and not to be discouraged. He would also urge us to get involved in our local communities and take actions to better the lives of our fellow human beings, particularly the disadvantaged and dispossessed. In that vein, I am delighted to introduce Professor Alvaro Bedoya, who will deliver this year's lecture. He is a founding director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law, where he is also a visiting professor. Alvaro is an expert on government surveillance and commercial data collection with a focus on the impact on immigrants and people of color. He has testified before Congress and state legislators, and his writing has appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times. But I would like to give you a sense of the Alvaro I know. I first met Alvaro a few years back when I was doing advocacy work on related issues, and we were both working with like-minded individuals and organizations. I was struck not only by Alvaro's intelligence, expertise, and leadership skills, but by the passion and commitment he brings to his work. Oh, and that's Alvaro's baby out there. I think my grandfather would approve of Alvaro. a Peruvian-born, naturalized American citizen who grew up in our country, but who deeply cherishes his Peruvian heritage. I think he would commend Alvaro's work on civil rights as it involves a right to privacy, as it is challenged daily by the new world of technology. And I think my grandfather would particularly appreciate Alvaro's commitment to helping others in the community where he lives. In 2009, Alvaro co-founded the Esperanza Education Fund, a scholarship and mentorship program that honors the brightest young immigrant students in the Washington region, regardless of ethnicity, national origin, or immigration status. To quote Alvaro on why he founded the fund, "I think that every child, regardless of where they are from or what their papers say, has a right to a good education." To date, the Esperanza Fund has awarded nearly $1 million in scholarships and helped almost 90 deserving students take steps to achieve their dreams and potential. Senator Chavez, too, believed everyone has a right to a good education. And as some of you may remember, before there was a University of New Mexico law school, there was the Dennis Chavez Law School. Let me explain. Before UNM was established in the 50s, there was no law school in the state, and few New Mexicans could afford to study out of state. My grandfather took it upon himself to recruit young New Mexicans to study law in Washington. He would then help them obtain jobs while they were studying. My grandfather did impose conditions. He must be able to review their grades, and the law students must be committed to returning to New Mexico once they graduated. A generation of New Mexico lawyers were the product of the Dennis Chavez Law School. With that, let me welcome our speaker and my good friend, Alvaro Bedoya. Thank you very much.
First of all, I am so grateful for that warm and generous introduction, Gloria. You know, one of the joys of preparing this lecture was finding out about how Senator Chavez's legacy echoed through my family's life. I teach in the classrooms of a law school that admitted Dennis Chavez at 30 years old when he had just a seventh grade formal education. And every morning, Seema gets up and drives to the National Institutes of Health, where she is a clinical psychologist, which Senator Chavez was a driving force behind decades later when he was one of the most powerful people in our country. For all of these things, for all of you, I am grateful. Let me start by setting a scene. The country's most prominent political figure is a liar. He says that the sitting president is actually working for our enemies. He demeans war heroes, but lies about his own service. He is a demagogue. "Foreigners are taking over our country," he says. Before, he says, "No nation would dare do this to us. What happened to our honor?" he says. He is effective, a fury on the campaign trail, with an uncanny ability to incite and hold a crowd. He undercuts basic institutions in our democracy, and people start to wonder, are lies more effective than the truth? This scene is not set in 2016, or 2019 for that matter. It is set in 1950, on May 12th, 1950. And I'm not quoting the 45th president of the United States. I'm quoting Joseph McCarthy, the late senator from Wisconsin. Joe McCarthy, who told the world that Harry Truman and the Democrats had committed, quote, 20 years of treason. Joe McCarthy, who derided George Marshall, yet lied his way into a distinguished flying cross. Joe McCarthy, who 2 months earlier stood at a Lincoln Day celebration in Wheeling, West Virginia, held up his hand and declared that he had a list of known communists who were working in our country's State Department. Joe McCarthy, who hauled people before the Senate, bullied them and shamed them, and in many cases ruined their professional lives, even though he often had no evidence of actual wrongdoing. May 12th, 1950. I want to call your attention to that date because it is 4 years before the Senate censured Joe McCarthy. It is 4 years before Joseph Welch would confront McCarthy and ask him if he had no decency. At long last, have you left no sense of decency? No. On May 12, 1950, Joe McCarthy was ascendant. He was growing in prominence and popularity. And many other elected officials, including John F. Kennedy, would not denounce him. Yet it was on that day that the senator from New Mexico, Denise Chavez, stood on the floor of the United States Senate and denounced Joseph McCarthy and his closest ally, a man named Louis Boudens. Senator Chavez made clear that dissent was our strength, not a weakness. I contend that we are a nation of dissenters, he said. Your ancestors and my ancestors left Europe because they were dissenters. Our nation was created by dissenters. Our ancestors were not satisfied. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States are based upon the fact that our ancestors were not satisfied with the way things were. And so Chavez explained, if you curb dissent, you don't just curb individual freedoms. You threaten our democratic way of life. He went on, the United States cannot gain strength from a population of safe people. People who have never thought or dreamed or spoken anything that is not prescribed and dictated by higher authority. If we accept only safe people, we become a slave people. Years later, colleagues would look back and say that it was this moment that started to turn the tide against Joseph McCarthy in the United States Senate. Because of Senator Chavez, quote, others dared speak out as well. Dionisio Chavez was born on April 8th, 1888, in the town of Los Chavez. He lived in a small house, dirt floors, no running water. And he rose from that house to become the first U.S.-born Hispanic to serve in the Senate, the fourth most senior member of the Senate, the chair of its most powerful subcommittee, and the chair of its Public Works Committee. Yet Chavez did not forget that house. He could not forget it. When Senator Chavez entered the Senate, there were no African-American senators, no Asian-American senators, no Native American senators. It was just Dennis Chavez. One of his colleagues, in fact, would refer to him as the senator from Mexico. Not New Mexico, the senator from Mexico. That, my friends, was a senator from Mississippi. I looked this up. Theodore Bilbo, an unabashed racist who was 5'2" tall and often referred to himself in the third person. This is a true story. His colleagues would call him the man because that is what he would call himself. Theodore Bilbo. Now, once he arrived in the Senate, Denise Chavez had a relentless focus on the disadvantaged and dispossessed. He sponsored legislation to empower Native Americans. He made sure that female nurses received the same pay as male officers of the same grade. He was the first to introduce a bill to fight discrimination in hiring during World War II, and that legislation would go on to become a foundation for modern civil rights legislation. Senator Stephen Young of Ohio would later say that, quote, Dennis Chavez was in many respects a very predictable man. He was always with the underdog. He was for the little fellows, whether they were struggling farmers fighting debts, drought, or low farm prices, underprivileged or forgotten American Indians, or working men seeking to better their lot and provide a more secure future for their children. At all times, he was the champion of the poor and the humble, a voice for the oppressed. Close quote. I see this lecture as a chance to advance Senator Chavez's legacy and his principles. And so far you've heard me speak about two of the senator's core commitments, his defense of individual freedom and civil liberty, and his belief in equality and promotion of civil rights. I want to talk to you about an idea at their intersection. I want to talk to you about the right to privacy. This might seem strange. You know, privacy, yes, it's one of our cherished and oldest civil liberties. Quote, the right most cherished by civilized men, said Justice Louis Brandeis. But is privacy a civil right? Who hears the word privacy and thinks about equality? Who hears the word surveillance and thinks about racism or bigotry or intolerance? Some, not many. Nowadays, the motto is that everyone is watched. We are all tracked. And what's more, we don't really talk about privacy as this felt, visceral thing. Privacy is in the business or technology section of the newspaper. It's about cookies on browsers. It's about data breaches. It's about Mark Zuckerberg and the NSA. And of course, yes, in a sense, that's right. But at its heart, privacy is about human dignity, whether the government feels it can invade your dignity, and whether the government feels it has to protect the most sensitive, the most intimate information about your life. And invasions of privacy, that watching and tracking and listening and sharing of data, those invasions do not affect everyone equally. Instead, across our history, you see that there is a color to surveillance. You see patterns. Pattern. We watch those who are less than. Will you spy on your superior, or will you spy on the poor man, the person of color, the immigrant, the heretic? We watch those who are other. Pattern. When those others organize and mobilize, that watching is redoubled. Surveillance becomes a tool to stop marginalized people from achieving power. Today, I want to trace those patterns through key moments in our history. I want to talk about how government has largely failed to reckon with those patterns. And in brief, I want to talk about what that reckoning might look like. Yes, privacy is a civil liberty. I'm here to tell you that also privacy is a civil right. And so when we talk about privacy only as a civil liberty, we erase those patterns of harm. We erase that color of surveillance. And when we talk about privacy only as a civil liberty, we also ignore the benefits of privacy. Yes, surveillance threatens vulnerable people fighting for equality, but privacy is what protects them and can make it possible. So let's start near the beginning. When he was the chair of the Subcommittee on Defense Appropriations, again, one of the most powerful subcommittees in Congress, Senator Chavez would sit next to a senator from Massachusetts named Leverett Saltonstall, the ranking Republican on that subcommittee. And he was every bit the Boston Brahmin that his name suggests. In fact, he could trace his family back to the Mayflower. And so when Senators Chavez and Saltonstall would sit down next to each other, maybe the hearing was about to start, the executive committee hadn't gotten started yet, they would make small talk. And one of their favorite subjects was, whose family came here first? You know where this is going. Was it Senator Saltonstall's family? Or was it Senator Chavez's family? It was Senator Chavez's family. In 1598, the Spanish explorer Pedro Lurán y Chávez arrived in this land that we now call New Mexico and settled here thanks to a land grant from the Spanish crown. Senator Saltonstall's family landed at Plymouth Rock in 1620. And so when people asked about his ancestry, Gloria tells me, Senator Chavez would helpfully tell people that he was American since before Plymouth Rock. There's a reason Senator Chavez would say that, and probably wasn't just because of his friend, Senator Saltonstall. That's because Plymouth Rock is more than a place, right? It is a part of the American origin story. Remember what he said. Our nation was created by dissenters. Your ancestors and my ancestors left their homes because they were dissenters. What were the pilgrims dissenting against? What were they dissatisfied with in the late 1500s, early 1600s, Tudor England? In grade school, we learned, you know, pilgrims worshiped differently than their neighbors. They were mistreated. They left England and settled in New England. The reality is darker. When Elizabeth I came to the throne in 1558, she wanted to be religiously tolerant. But after the Catholic Pope excommunicated her, that was wiped away. She built a network of spies and informants to root out perceived threats to her reign. And her main focus was on Catholics. Catholics feared that their neighbors, as a result of that, would report them to the authorities. And in fact, a system of bounties was created for telling on your Catholic neighbor. This system of network reporting, the system of surveillance was such that many Catholics actually built secret compartments into their houses called priest holes, where clergy could hide if an agent of the crown happened to stop by the house. Now, in fairness, a small group of Catholics was trying to murder Queen Elizabeth. Perhaps you've heard of one of them, their members, Guido Fox, who you may know as Guy Fox, of the famous gunpowder plot. Now, life is weird. Now, Guy Fox has become something of a mascot for the anonymous hacking group. You know, you never know. But it wasn't just about Catholics. It wasn't just about Guy Fox, Guido Fox. Elizabeth also trained her attention on the Puritan separatists that we now know as pilgrims. Under her reign and under that of her successor, James I, also a Tudor, the pilgrims also lived in a surveillance state. Example, the governor of Plymouth Colony was a man named William Bradford. He had been a passenger on the Mayflower, and when he wrote about the pilgrims' time in England, he described being, quote, hunted and persecuted, their houses beset and watched night and day. It was a dystopia. So much so that at the end of her reign, Elizabeth commissioned a special portrait, the so-called rainbow portrait, which you've been seeing today. Perhaps those of you in the front row noticed Elizabeth's gown. It is embroidered in human eyes and ears. Experts say that she wanted to tell her subjects, quote, the queen watches and listens vigilantly, seeing in all perspectives and hearing in all directions. Plymouth Rock, the pilgrims. This origin story of our republic isn't just a story about religious persecution. It is a story about surveillance, about a government's need to watch and control a heretical minority. And I want to pause because when we talk about the history of surveillance and its disparate impact, we have to be careful because we can't reinforce, we can't reify the idea that the targets of surveillance are helpless victims. Often, in fact, the other is being watched precisely because they are fighting back. And sometimes the others win. And that watching fails and is utterly useless. Members of the New Mexico legislature, as I know you all know, recently sought to create a holiday in memory of not just Dennis Chavez, but also Cesar Chavez. And that holiday would have actually fallen, by my reckoning, tomorrow, on the first Friday of April. So let's talk about Cesar Chavez. The FBI surveilled Cesar Chavez for roughly a decade. They justified the initial surveillance of Cesar Chavez partly in the fact that a communist newspaper ran this photo of Dolores Huerta, not Chavez, but Huerta. And that FBI investigation intensified when the FBI learned that the photographer who took the photo in that communist newspaper was, surprise, likely a communist. So the FBI was off to the races. The FBI followed Cesar Chavez everywhere he went. Farm workers picket Delano, grape growers, FBI's there. Farm workers march to the San Joaquin Valley to Sacramento, FBI on the route. Farm workers begin to organize in the Rio Grande Valley, FBI follows. The final FBI file was 1,500 pages long. It listed Chavez's daily routine, what he ate for breakfast, the specific songs that Joan Baez sang at his rallies, his relatives, where they worked, where they lived. It was a minutely detailed portrait of Cesar Chavez's life that has actually proven quite useful for modern historians of the farm worker civil rights movement. What won't you find in those 1,500 pages? A single incriminating detail. Cesar Chavez was not a communist. His associates, not communists. He was faithful to his wife. He did not misuse union funds. And when the farm workers demonstrated, when they used their bodies to effect change, they were not violent. They turned the other cheek. In fact, there are actually FBI telegrams on farm worker protests that literally say in all caps, extremely orderly. And there is a note of frustration to them because the FBI never caught Cesar Chavez for anything. Unfortunately, Cesar Chavez's story is not common. The man is basically a saint. The rest of us are human. Marcus Garvey was human. J. Edgar Hoover followed him also. His agents would literally peer into the windows of his hotel rooms. But Hoover actually hadn't caught Garvey on anything yet, until the government got a hold of a marketing brochure for stock in the Black Star Line, which Garvey founded and ran, showing the world that African Americans could be captains of industry and commerce too. This brochure showed a handsome steamship named for Phyllis Wheatley, the famous African American poet. And if you could zoom in a little bit, and unfortunately I don't have the zoom, you'd see the name Phyllis Wheatley on this steamship. But Garvey had moved too quickly. He was negotiating for that ship, and it was close to sail. He didn't own it yet. In fact, there was no such ship that had those letters on its side, and the sale fell through. So when the government learned this, it used it to charge and convict Garvey of mail fraud. They sent him to prison, and they deported him in 1927. Billie Holiday was human. In 1939, She stood on the stage of a nightclub in Greenwich Village and sang a protest poem against lynching, which many of you are familiar with. Quote, "Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees." That song and her protest against lynching was a sensation. But Holiday was an addict. And immediately after Strange Fruit entered her repertoire, the head of the then Federal Bureau of Narcotics, a predecessor to the modern Drug Enforcement Administration, assigned an undercover agent to follow Holiday, to ingratiate himself into her circle, and eventually set her up for a drug bust. Holiday went to prison for a year. She was stripped of her cabaret license, which meant she could no longer sing in any nightclub. It was the start of a long decline. And as many of you know, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was human. Hoover's FBI followed him, wiretapped him, and bugged his hotels. Senior FBI officials compiled a recording of his extramarital affairs and sent it to his wife. Pardon me, sent it to his office, actually, along with a note threatening blackmail and implying that Dr. King should kill himself. The package was then forwarded to the King family home. Apparently, Coretta Scott King enjoyed listening to recordings of Dr. King's speeches, and it was she who opened it. "They are out to break me," Dr. King told a friend. "They are out to get me, harass me, and break my spirit." Now, it's easy to focus on J. Edgar Hoover, but these patterns predated him, and they continue to this day. So let's talk about today. Let's talk about how those patterns continue today. In January 2017, when the president barred travel to the United States from several Muslim-majority countries, people mobilized en masse. They went to those airports. Fewer people, however, focused on a different provision in Section 4 of that same executive order. Section 4 called for every traveler to the U.S. to be, quote, vetted to see if they would, quote, become a positively contributing member of society, close quote, and if they would be able to, quote, make contributions to the national interest. Now, I'm sure there are immigration law scholars in the room today, and they would know that these are either entirely duplicative forms of vetting or forms of vetting that find no purchase in American federal immigration law because they do not exist. These standards are either duplicative or non-existent. Fewer people still notice the ICE procurement documents posted in the summer of 2017 proposing to build out a system to implement Section 4. How are they going to build it out? Well, according to the documents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement wanted to automatically and continuously scan immigrants' social media, their Facebook, their Twitter, their Instagram posts. The plan was to flag a minimum of 10,000 people a year for deportation investigations. Thankfully, a coalition of civil rights and privacy organizations was able to stop that system. But unfortunately, we have seen no limit to these kinds of abuses. An administration that sees immigrants as drug dealers, as animals, as monsters, as rapists, will do anything it wants to a vulnerable person, to a vulnerable immigrant. It will break any law, violate any norm, even take advantage of a child's pain and trust. What do I mean by that? Let's talk about a story that ran in Santa Fe, New Mexico 2 years ago. He's a teenager living in Guatemala with his uncle. He hasn't seen his brother's named Gary, or Gary, in more than a decade. And Gary actually lives in Santa Fe. But the teen needs to get out. His uncle abuses him. So he leaves his village, he crosses Sonora, and he shows up at the Arizona border. The teen is taken into custody. Officials from our government ask him, quote, "Do you have any other close family members who live in the U.S.?" And as you might imagine, this question actually scares a lot of children because they know that a lot of their family is undocumented and that if they were to give that information, it would put that family at risk. But the kids are terrified. They want to be with their families. And so they take the risk and they give the Office of Refugee Resettlement, their names. And in this case, Gary's brother gave them his name and phone number. So Gary gets a call in Santa Fe. He lives with his wife, Marisol, who's actually pictured here, and their two kids, one 7 months and one 11 years old. Gary is undocumented. The government official at the end of the line assures him that if he gives them his information, that won't be used to find and deport him. It will be just used to reunite him with his brother. So he does that. He tells them where he lives. He gives them that information. He wants to take care of his little brother. By the time the Santa Fe New Mexican ran the story, Gary wasn't living in Santa Fe anymore. He was in a detention facility in Chaparral, waiting for his deportation hearing. Once his brother told the government his name, and once Gary came forward, ICE came for him, arrested him, and placed him in deportation proceedings. That's because since last summer, ICE has publicly reserved the right to use information obtained from scared, detained children at the border to find, arrest, and deport their families. And it's happened to over 150 people, including at least three here in New Mexico. There's a detail here that I think is haunting. Last fall, when a coalition of NGOs wrote a letter to DHS and HHS denouncing what was happening, there was an unusual number of Japanese-American organizations who signed on. The Japanese-American Citizens League, the Fred T. Korematsu Center for Law and Equality, the Japanese-American Service Committee. There are lots of other civil rights groups, but no other national origin group that was represented like that. Why? Well, it turns out that in the 1940s, when our government ordered Japanese Americans into internment camps to be incarcerated, they had help from the census. In 1940, Japanese American families were surveyed, and they were promised, because federal law told them, that their information would remain confidential. But Congress waived those rules, 1942. And then the government used that confidential census data to find and incarcerate Japanese Americans in internment camps like the ones that were here in New Mexico in Lordsburg and Santa Fe. On May 12, 1950, when Senator Chavez said, "We are a nation of dissenters," when he said, "Your ancestors and my ancestors left their homes because they were not satisfied," he wasn't just talking about pilgrims. He was talking about immigrants. He was talking about activists. He was talking about vulnerable people who dared to want more. Surveillance is a tool that the powerful use to stop that. On June 6, 2013, I was sitting down for dinner at Bertucci's on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C., and my BlackBerry started lighting up, and I opened it up. And Edward Snowden had just revealed that the NSA was tracking the calls of not one, not some, but millions of Verizon customers, all Verizon Business Services customers. And that leak ushered in the most intense and important surveillance debate in a generation. At that time, I was the chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law. And it was my job to run one of the key subcommittees tasked with finding out what the NSA was doing and then writing legislation to rein the NSA in. And the next year was a blur of hearings and negotiations. And actually, the NSA would do this brilliant thing. They negotiate in good faith, but they'd do this brilliant thing where they would send all these guys into a negotiation, they walk into the room, and after this long negotiation, you know, they'd agree to something. And then for the next negotiation, they would send a totally different group of people that had like no recollection of the first conversation. It was brilliant. But we made some progress. We passed an NSA reform bill with many strengths and many weaknesses. Yet even then, in that haze of activity, I remember thinking to myself, when are we going to talk about the history of surveillance and the people it affects? You know, we're calling business groups to testify, civil liberties groups. Why aren't we calling civil rights groups? Once I left the Senate and had the chance to go to Georgetown Law, I had the time to reread transcripts and reread all the news stories in that period. And it turns out it was worse than I thought, and here's why. Because it turns out that 3 months after Edward Snowden went public, the NSA itself disclosed that it wasn't just the FBI who'd wiretapped Martin Luther King. The NSA had wiretapped Dr. King also, along with Whitney Young, who's just over his left shoulder from the National Urban League, and Muhammad Ali. This was part of Operation Minaret, an operation aimed at finding out if U.S. political activists were working with the Soviet Union, which they were not. Now, in any legislature, Congress, state legislature, when you debate policy, you talk about the highs and lows. And what I mean by that is you talk about what happens when everything goes great and what happens when everything goes terrible. What's the worst possible thing that can happen? And in 2013 and 2014, the threat of surveillance to civil rights wasn't this amorphous, ambiguous thing. It was staring us in the face. And you would think that the senators would debate that. They didn't. There were 10 NSA reform hearings in the Senate between Edward Snowden's first leak and ultimate passage of the USA Freedom Act. That was the bill to reform the NSA 2 years later. There were countless floor speeches about the NSA, yet in the entirety of that debate, never, not once, did anyone even say Martin Luther King's name. The senators never discussed, in fact, any aspect in depth of how surveillance can be and has been used to target and harm racial and religious minorities. The senators talked about how the revelations hurt the relationships with our allies. They quantified in dollars the cost of lost clients to American cloud computing companies and other American tech companies. They called three separate industry witnesses to talk about it. The senators even spoke about the harm of leaks to the military, which I guess is logical. They talked about the harm to morale, to reputation, to recruiting. But when it came time to talk about how NSA spying was affecting people, it was a high-level discussion about a right to privacy, free speech, about chilling effects. It was all about how the spying had violated the privacy of millions of Americans, all my constituents. It was the same story of everyone has watched. Now, here again, I want to pause because, to be honest, I'm just as guilty as the other folks in the Senate were. I organized one of those hearings. I called one of those industry witnesses when I could have called a civil rights witness. And I staffed my boss at numerous other hearings, floor speeches, and public events. I was part of the problem. But what I want to stress to you is that what happened in that NSA reform debate is the rule, not the exception. When Congress meets to talk about surveillance, be it police surveillance, but particularly NSA surveillance, it is the exceptional member of Congress who sees those patterns and who talks about them and works to reverse them. Some good news. In the last 2 years, this has started to change. In particular, Chairman Elijah Cummings of the House Oversight Committee, Chairman Benny Thompson, the House Homeland Security Committee, Representative Cedric Richmond of the Congressional Black Caucus, and others are starting to ask questions. Questions about racial bias in face recognition technology. Questions about how ICE planned to scan social media of all immigrants to target deportations. Questions about how surveillance isn't just a threat to liberty. It is a threat to equality also. We still have a long road ahead of us, though. And so in closing, I want to offer, in brief, some thoughts about what it might look like for Congress to finally reckon with the color of surveillance. It looks like Congress calling the NAACP, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, Muslim Advocates, Color of Change, to testify not just at criminal justice reform hearings, but at hearings involving the NSA and the FBI and CIA. It looks like ICE being asked questions at oversight hearings about the vast surveillance network they have built inside of our country. A surveillance network that turns on automated license plate readers and scans of driver's license photos at our departments of motor vehicles. We have to recognize that ICE is not just a law enforcement agency, it is a surveillance agency also. It looks like acknowledging the obvious fact that the primary goal of so much domestic surveillance is simply watching and controlling Muslim people. It looks like quantifying the impact of surveillance, not just on Google or Facebook or Amazon Web Services, but on people, non-corporate people. For years, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has demanded that the intelligence community estimate how many Americans had their communications collected under Section 702. This is an NSA program that actually collected the content of communications, not just the metadata. That's great, but Congress needs to go further. It's not enough to count people. Congress should also ask who they are, at least in general terms. Where do they live? Where do they come from? What do they look like? Right this second, you can actually go online and pull down how many times federal judges here in New Mexico have ordered wiretaps, the crimes that those wiretaps were used to investigate, how many people were arrested, how many people of all those people arrested were actually convicted. Wiretaps have been around for ages. Why can't we do this for any surveillance technology invented in the 21st century? The last part of this vision I want to leave you with is a hopeful one. And I've spent pretty much the entirety of this lecture talking about how surveillance harms vulnerable people. We can't forget, however, how privacy empowers them. Harriet Tubman escaped bondage on the Eastern Shore of Maryland in 1849. And as everyone knows, after she escaped, she began going back and rescuing other enslaved people and guiding them to freedom. What most people do not realize is that Harriet Tubman returned repeatedly to the one region where she would be most recognizable and most at risk, the Eastern Shore of Maryland. She wanted to free the rest of her family, and she did, and she was never caught. After the Civil War, Tubman struggled to obtain a pension for her service in the Union Army. And so in 1868, a group of abolitionists organized for a biography to be published about Tubman to both publicize her story and raise funds for her. And they called on Tubman's peers, and you can only imagine who Tubman's peers were in that day, to write testimonials on her behalf. And Frederick Douglass answered that call and wrote one of those testimonials. And let me read you an excerpt of what he wrote. "Most of what I have done," and he addresses this to Harriet Tubman herself, "most of what I have done and suffered in the service of our country has been public. You, on the other hand, have labored in a private way. I have wrought in the day, you in the night. I have had the applause of the crowd, while the most that you have done has been witnessed by a few trembling, scarred, and footsore bondmen and women. The midnight sky and the silent stars have been the witnesses of your devotion to freedom and your heroism. There was a time when it was legal. That's what Frederick Douglass wrote. And he wrote that because, you know, there was a time when it was legal to own people and illegal for them to run away. There was a time, not so long ago, when it was basically illegal for black people to march in the streets of Selma. When there is that moral lag, that gap between what is legal and what is right, privacy is the shield that allows the unpopular and persecuted to survive, even thrive. It is what allows them to labor in a private way, far beyond the government's eyes. And so as we build this world of pervasive surveillance, we have to ask ourselves, are we building a world without underground railroads? Are we building a world where that kind of dissent is impossible? Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Now, we rejoin Professor Álvaro Bedoya on a discussion on surveillance. Welcome to Generation Justice.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Please share with us more about yourself.
My name is Álvaro Bedoya. I work on privacy issues, and I work on a particular slice of privacy issues, which is how surveillance, how watching, how monitoring affects people of color, affects immigrants, affects people who belong to a minority religious group, affects anyone who hasn't historically had power in our society. And the reason I am really interested in that is that in the 21st century, what people like to say is that everyone is watched and privacy is dead and everyone is tracked. And what gets erased in that saying, what gets erased in that conversation is the fact that certain people are watched an awful lot more than others. And those people tend to be black, brown, Muslim, Mormon, from communities that historically have not had power or have been disadvantaged in our country. And I just named two. There's, you know, dozens and dozens more that we could talk about in terms of being LGBTQ, in terms of being a low-income worker or a poor person. This is what I spend a lot of time researching and advocating on.
Thank you for taking the time to be here with us. Can you tell us more about how you come to work in surveillance and civil rights?
Certainly. I went to work for the United States Senate in 2009, and I worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And back then, I wasn't really a privacy advocate, but I started to be asked to handle a lot of privacy questions about how companies like Facebook or Google were tracking people online. And we held some oversight hearings in the subcommittee that I started to run as a staffer called the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law. And so I started to see that privacy questions often looked a lot like the questions I was more familiar with, which were questions about immigrant rights or labor rights or voting rights, where there are people who don't have that much power, who are mistreated or who are discounted or who are not treated right by people who do have power. And oftentimes, the people who don't have power are diffuse. They don't know each other. They aren't visible. They aren't connected. Whereas the people who do have power are connected. They're concentrated. They do talk to each other. They do coordinate. They do arrange strategy. And I started to see that dynamic playing out in what we were looking at in privacy, where companies had all this power. They are lobbying to keep any kind of privacy protections out of our nation's law books. Whereas people who did care about privacy weren't organized and they weren't knocking on the doors of Congress. And so I started seeing those issues. But it all came to a head in June of 2013, when at the time I was the chief counsel of the Privacy Subcommittee, and a guy named Edward Snowden started releasing information via The Guardian and The Washington Post about NSA surveillance. And what happened soon afterwards is that the NSA released that it hadn't just been the FBI who had wiretapped Martin Luther King, but it was the NSA also. The NSA had also wiretapped Martin Luther King. And so I had thought that all these people would start talking about this in the Senate, and I thought that all these civil rights organizations were going to be knocking down my door saying, hey, this isn't just about privacy, this isn't just about civil liberties, this is about civil rights, and this is about an act, surveillance, that has been disproportionately used to hurt our people, to hurt people of color, to hurt vulnerable people. And that never happened. You know, I don't think I ever had any meeting requested with our subcommittee from civil rights organizations. And it wasn't really their fault because the Senate really wasn't asking them to come to the table. There were no witnesses from civil rights organizations. Senators didn't talk about Martin Luther King. They didn't talk about the disparate impact of NSA surveillance. They talked about everyone is watched. And so it was coming out of this experience that I thought, I want to be more a part of this conversation. And so I left the Senate. I founded a think tank at Georgetown Law called the Center on Privacy and Technology, but really it should kind of be the Center on Privacy, Technology, and Civil Rights, because that is the intersection of work that we focus on. And that's how we came to it.
Thank you for the work that you do and for informing us about surveillance. I'm going to switch to Spanish now for the next question.
Como no? Listo.
And you can answer in English if you feel more comfortable.
Well, I will give it a shot in Spanish. Y si está bien masticado, me dices y cambiamos al inglés.
Okay. En tu discurso realizado en UNM Law School, tú mencionaste que la privacidad es un derecho civil. ¿De qué manera los entes gubernamentales vigilan a nuestra gente sin que nos demos cuenta?
Uy, hay un sinfín de maneras en que nos vigilan y nos monitorean. Y el problema es justamente el problema que has indicado, que nosotros no podemos ver cuando el gobierno nos vigila. Te doy varios ejemplos. Imagínate si cada mes un agente de la NSA tocaría tu puerta para preguntarte, ok, señora, por favor, necesitamos que usted nos indique quién ha llamado, cuándo los ha llamado y por cuánto tiempo los llamó, por cuánto tiempo duró la llamada y cuán larga fue la llamada, ¿no? Y necesito que usted haga esto para cada llamada que ha realizado en el último mes, ¿ya? Imagínate que esto ocurriría en cada familia, en cada casa, a lo largo de todo este país. La gente estaría indignada, ¿no? Rechazaría este tipo de monitoreo, este tipo de vigilancia, por ser una intrusión fatal, ¿no? Una violación profunda a nuestro sentido de seguridad, de privacidad. Pero no hacen eso y no hacen ese monitoreo de esa manera tan visible, tan transparente. En vez, lo que vemos es que todo eso se realiza. Ese monitoreo se realizó a lo largo de una década, pero se realizó de una manera secreta, ¿ya? Porque a partir de los primeros años del año, a partir de creo que 2006, 2007, pero aún antes de eso, este monitoreo de las llamadas que realizábamos se realizaba, pero era un secreto para casi todo el mundo, ¿no? Solo ciertos senadores y ciertos miembros del Congreso se enteraron del tema, y cuando el público se enteró del tema, sí, mucha gente se indignó, ¿no? Denunciaron esta práctica, pero seguía siendo una práctica cuasi secreta, ¿no? Porque ese monitoreo, ese rastreo, esa vigilancia aún no era algo visible que podíamos ver, tocar, interactuar. Era algo no transparente. Entonces yo creo que en términos de la privacidad, un problema presente y profundo es el hecho que muchas violaciones de nuestra privacidad son secretas, son invisibles. Y parte de nuestro trabajo es hacerlas más visibles, particularmente por las comunidades de gente de pocos recursos, de gente latina, de gente people of color, de gente que son inmigrantes, de gente que es musulmana o forma parte de otras religiones que no son mayoritarias de nuestro país. Esa es nuestra labor, ¿no? Hacer más transparente ese monitoreo.
Okay, muchas gracias por la aclaración.
No, did I do okay mi castellano o no?
Sí, lo hiciste muy bien.
Okay, gracias.
Pero tengo una pregunta al respecto de cuando dijiste que el gobierno vigila a las personas de color y a los inmigrantes. ¿De qué manera podemos prevenir esto? ¿Cómo podemos protegernos?
Sí, entonces mira, hay cosas que cada individuo puede hacer, ¿ya? Entonces al ir al internet y nomás ponerte en un browser y empezar a ver el internet, puedes hacer varias cosas. Primero puedes usar lo que se llama un VPN, V, B chica, P, N. Y esto es una red virtual Las cifras dicen P chica es virtual, P es de private, privado, y N es de network. Entonces es una red privada virtual que, y al usar una red privada virtual, te habilita a usar el internet y ver el internet sin que otros te monitoreen, ¿ya? Sin que tu proveedor de servicio de internet, Comcast, por ejemplo, o Xfinity, sin que ellos o AT&T, lo que sea, puedan ver tu tráfico, ¿ya? Además, cuando usas el sistema, también puedes usar un browser, una extension en tu browser que se llama Privacy Badger. No sé cómo se traduce Badger en castellano, pero Privacy Badger, que es algo que puedes instalar en un browser como Chrome y que te protege ante las empresas en la internet que no sean tus internet service providers, ¿ya? Eso también te protege. También puedes usar lo que se llama un password manager, un administrador de contraseñas que guarda tus contraseñas y produce contraseñas complicadas. Yo sospecho que mucha gente que está escuchando esta entrevista va a utilizar una contraseña muy básica, ¿no? Una palabra, tu nombre y el año en que naciste, ¿no? El nombre de tu mascota, el año en que nació tu hijo o tu hija, ¿no? Pero lo que ocurre es que esas contraseñas son muy fáciles de adivinar. Entonces, no sé, tenemos que usar contraseñas complicadas, largas, que no tienen palabras completas, y un administrador de contraseñas te ayuda a hacer eso, ¿ya? Pero, para ser muy honesto, hay muchas cosas que nosotros como individuos no podemos hacer, ¿ya? Porque muchos de los problemas surgen de problemas sistemáticos, ¿ya? De los propios sistemas gubernamentales y sistemas corporativos con quien interactuamos en nuestra vida cotidiana. Entonces, lo que necesitamos es una movilización política, ¿ya? Si estás escuchando esto y estás en New Mexico, o estás en Arizona, o estás en cualquier otro estado, tú puedes ir a tu estado y demandar y denunciar invasiones de tu privacidad y demandar que, por ejemplo, tu gobierno estatal no coopere con ICE, con la migra, efectivamente, ¿no? Con la rama del gobierno federal que se enfoca en deportar a la gente, ¿ya? Tú puedes ir a tu gobierno estatal y demandar eso, ¿ya? Tú puedes ir a tu gobierno, a tu ciudad, a tu municipalidad y demandar que ellos no contraten con, por ejemplo, un proveedor de placas. De placas, ¿no? Hay muchas empresas que proveen un servicio de lectura de placas automática donde ellos dicen, mira, Ciudad X, ustedes tienen un problema con gente que se estaciona y se queda ahí 3 horas mientras que solo deben quedarse 1 hora. Nosotros podemos entrar a tu ciudad y podemos leer todas esas placas y podemos decirte, mira, acá está este señor que le debes cobrar, poner esta multa por estar en ese lugar de estacionamiento por demasiado tiempo. También puedes decir, ustedes tienen un problema con gente que no paga esas multas y no aparece en la corte cuando les toca aparecerse para pagar la multa. Yo puedo ubicar a esa gente por medio de sus placas, ¿no? Pero ¿qué ocurre? Muchas municipalidades contratan con estas empresas, pero no saben que esas empresas luego van y ofrecen toda esa información a ICE, a Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a la migra, para ayudar a ICE encontrar a gente para deportar, ¿no? Entonces tú también como una miembro de tu comunidad puedes ir a tu municipalidad y demandar que ellos no contraten con este tipo de empresa. Esto ocurrió en California, ocurrió en varios otros lugares y eso es algo que puedes hacer para impactar el sistema de monitoreo en que te encuentras. Hay una, I know I'm talking a lot, the last thing I will say es que hay una ley, hay un proyecto de ley modelo que se llama CCOPS y me olvido de qué significan las cifras, pero es un proyecto de ley que muchas municipalidades han aprobado que instituye todo un sistema de checks and balances a sistemas de monitoreo y vigilancia dentro de estados y municipalidades, medio que instituye todo un sistema de chequeos y de reportaje y de transparencia y de oportunidades para la propia comunidad de impactar a estos sistemas por medio de presentaciones en las reuniones del City Council, ese tipo de cosa. Entonces, si estás escuchando esto y tú eres un activista, tú eres una persona activa políticamente, ustedes pueden ir y pedir que tu municipalidad apruebe un proyecto de ley de CCOPS. Y el ACLU es la organización que promueve este proyecto de ley.
Muchas gracias por compartir eso con nosotros. Como individuos, como tú mencionaste, no podemos hacer mucho, pero sí hay algunas maneras en las que nos podemos proteger. I'm going to switch to English now. And what are some of the other systems we rely on that could be vulnerable to hacking and surveillance? and what should we be aware of to protect ourselves?
The issue that we have with these systems is a combination of wanting to tell people about these systems of surveillance, and to be really honest with you, Barbara, not wanting to depress people, because in a lot of instances, they can't do anything about this. And so, for example, in Vermont, there was a case where ICE was going to the Vermont DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and it was requesting facial recognition searches of their driver's licenses, which included undocumented people, to try and find people. And so, you know, I don't know what to tell people. I think that if you're undocumented, it's probably a good idea to have a driver's license to give you more protection when you drive. But, you know, I don't know whether ICE is going to access those systems. And so I don't know what the trade-off is between wanting to be regularized when you drive and have that security when you drive and wanting to avoid ICE looking for you. And so it's difficult for me as a privacy advocate to just name systems other than like the internet without having a ready solution at hand. And so I kind of don't want to answer the question if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, frankly, I am just really grateful for the work that you do at Generation Justice, and I encourage you to keep on asking these questions, and I want you to count me as an ally. You know, I 100% support what you do, and honored and flattered to be asked to do this interview.
Thank you. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. De verdad que necesitamos
tu... Por favor, Bárbara.
Sí, necesitamos tu conocimiento, porque como personas de color, muchas veces no entendemos de qué manera somos vigilados y monitoreados. Entonces, como tú dijiste, hay algunas cosas que podemos hacer, otras cosas no podemos controlar, pero muy felices aquí en Generation Justice de poder hablar contigo. Gracias por venir aquí a New Mexico a informar a nuestra comunidad acerca de la vigilancia por parte del gobierno.
Mil gracias y me encantaría regresar a hablar con ustedes más. Y yo mismo puedo pagar el pasaje, no se preocupen por dinero, pero me encantaría verlos de nuevo y seguir formando parte de sus conversaciones y sus esfuerzos.
Thank you, Professor Álvaro Bedoya, for Generation Justice. I'm Bárbara Ramírez.
We hope you've enjoyed this hour of surveillance education. We'd like to thank our guest, Professor Álvaro Bedoya. And thank you to Gloria Tristani and the University of New Mexico School of Law. Tonight's hour of radio was produced by Kateri Zuni and Roberta Rael. We want to give a big shout out to all of our youth producers. We could not do what we do without you. Generation Justice would also like to thank KUNM for bringing the voices of young people to you, KUNM listeners. Our website is generationjustice.org. where you can check out all of our multimedia work and listen to our podcasts, which are also available on SoundCloud and iTunes. We're active on social media. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Generation Justice is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation with additional funding from the Conalma Health Foundation. And of course, all of you who have contributed to our project by visiting our website and clicking Donate. Our opening song is Youth of the Nation by POD. I'm Bárbara Ramírez. Buenas noches.